everyone. I'm Rania Kallik, and this is Dispatches. As tensions continue to heat up across the Middle East over the U.S.-backed Israeli genocide in Gaza, there's growing concern that the violence could escalate into a bigger regional war that would more directly draw in the U.S. and Iran. U.S. officials and their media stenographers pour fuel on the fire by portraying resistance axis groups like Hezbollah, Hamas, Iraq's PMF, and Yemen's Ansar Allah as Iranian-backed puppets and proxies. So what is Iran's actual role in the resistance axis? Why does Iran support Palestine? Is it anti-imperialism or self-interest? And how do average Iranians feel about it all? To discuss this and more, I'm joined by Navid Zarinel, a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Tehran. But before we jump into it, this is just part of this episode. The full interview is available to Breakthrough News members only. You can become a member at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. And as always, be sure to hit the subscribe button and the bell so you get a notification whenever we post new content. And if you appreciate this show, you can also donate below on YouTube. Navid, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, Rania.
Well, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. You're speaking to me from Iran, and there's obviously so much happening in the region, dealing with the genocide in Gaza and also, you know, what we're seeing at the border with Lebanon, what we're seeing happening in Iraq between the Iraqis and the Americans. You know, the Yemeni situation, I think, has surprised a lot of us in these past few months. But of course, whenever we hear about all of these different resistance axis groups across the Middle East, it always goes back to Iran, right? Like the entire American media apparatus is like, these are all Iran-backed militias. The American officials that comment on what's happening in all of these places make sure to always include Iran's role in being allied with a lot of these groups. So let's start there. When we talk about the resistance axis across the Middle East, which I've covered a lot on this show, what is Iran's role in the resistance axis? Excuse me. And does the average Iranian like understand the role of the resistance axis and specifically Iran's position in it?
Sure. So I think it's good to start with some historical context here. So when it comes to Iran's role in the resistance axis, it all began with Mohammad Mossadegh, who was the prime minister of Iran in the year 1951. And the context in which he was acting, it was a broader decolonization context. So you had decolonization movements all over Asia and Africa. So you had India's decolonization movement, for example, that was happening around the same time. It began in the early 20th century, but by the 1940s, Indians gained independence from Britain that led to the partition in 1947. And similarly, the Iranians are trying to gain oil independence from the British. And Mohammad Mossadegh nationalizes Iranian oil. And we all know what happened after. I think your audience is familiar with the history here. So because the British oil was threatened, the British persuaded the Americans to collaborate with them in order to orchestrate a coup d'etat against Mohammad Mossadegh. After the coup d'etat, the Shah of Iran, that was backed by the U.S., came back to power in 1953, and he allied with American imperialism. So Iran's role from a country that was resisting Anglo-American imperialism shifted to a country that allied with American imperialism. And a major example of this was the Baghdad Pact in 1955. So 2 years after the Shah came back to power, the British, joined by the Americans, they persuaded a pact with the intention of bringing West Asian or Middle Eastern countries within the Anglo-American sphere of influence, and also to strengthen their hold over the Persian Gulf oil fields that were threatened 4 years earlier. So the countries that joined were Turkey, Iraq, Pakistan and Iran, and their intention was to have economic cooperation and also to receive military aid from the U.S. And because of the Baghdad Pact, and because of the closeness that the Baghdad Pact generated to Anglo-American power, Shah remained firmly within the imperialist camp throughout his rule until 1979. And part of that meant that he opposed Arab nationalism. So he was actually very much opposed to Nasser of Egypt. And if you review the correspondences that the Iranian Foreign Ministry had at the time, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and read the documents and the memos and the summaries of talking points, you see that the Shah was very much opposed to Nasser and really disliked him. And also went because we're talking about Palestinians today and the war on Gaza. Shah had some general sympathy with the Palestinians. So if you actually watch his interviews with Mike Wallace, the American journalist, you see that he expresses some general sympathy for the Palestinians. But at the end of the day, he was very much a conservative on the issue. And for the most part, he just followed the U.S. position on the Palestinian issue. And all of this changes after the 1979 revolution. So Iran from 51 being in the resistance camp, in a sense, goes to the imperialist camp. But by 1979, with the revolution, it shifts back to the resistance camp. And a major reason for this is that the Shah was having a crisis of legitimacy because of the way he came to power, which was through a CIA-assisted coup d'etat, and also because he allied with the imperialist position. So a major principle of the revolution became anti-imperialism. So the socialists, the Islamists, and the nationalists, and the various political ideologies that united against the Shah, they were all anti-imperialists, and that was a very big a core component of the revolution. And it wasn't just opposition to Western imperialism, it was also opposition to Soviet influence. So aside from a number of communist parties and groups, a major slogan of the revolution was that Na Sharqi Na Gharbi Jumhuriya Islami, which meant neither East nor West, the Islamic Republic. And this anti-imperialist position, especially opposition to Western imperialism after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, continued well into the present. So today you see that Iran is building alliances with resistant groups in Iraq, in Yemen, and also in Lebanon, where you are, Rania. And this was happening as early as the 1970s. So even before the revolution, you had a lot of the Shia revolutionaries who would go to Lebanon in order to build a transnational alliance against American imperialism. And a major example of this was Mustafa Chamran, who was an Iranian academic, was actually American educated, I think it was at Berkeley. And he left the U.S. and went to Lebanon in order to fight against U.S. imperialism and against the power of the Shah. And then he comes back to Iran in the 1980s and he's killed in the Iran-Iraq war. But what I should emphasize is that Iran's role in the resistance axis after a revolution is not merely sectarian, because I mentioned Mustafa Chamran's interest in the Shias of Lebanon, but it was not merely sectarian and is not merely sectarian today, because Iran also assists Sunni groups such as Hamas and also even non-Muslims. So it tries to build alliances with Latin American countries that are opposing imperialism, such as Venezuela and its alliance with the Bolivarian Revolution. And also the mechanisms that Iran uses in order to fight imperialism and assist the groups that it allies with are things such as training and funding, and to a lesser extent, soft power by trying to institute Shia centers or Iranian cultural centers in Latin American countries, even, you know, in very far off lands. And in other places such as Nigeria, there's a lot of organic support that because of the Shia affiliation, a lot of the people turn towards Iran, similar in Pakistan and other countries that have Shia populations. But again, it is not merely sectarian. There's also more universal elements to Iran's interest in resistance. And I think you asked about what an average Iranian thinks about Iran's role in the resistance. And I suppose it depends on how you define an average Iranian. I guess we also have these notions in the U.S., an average Joe that votes for a particular candidate. So it depends how you define an average Iranian. But I would say that generally there's enough support for the governments to conduct this regional resistance, that there is some opposition. There are some people who oppose any funding to foreign entities, to foreign groups. But for the most part, I would say there is sufficient support for the government to conduct its regional resistance. And you even have volunteer forces when Iran has extra national operations. And I guess one problem with trying to assess what a so-called average Iranian thinks is that people are not always thinking clearly or with evidence about issues. There's a lot of conspiratorial thinking that happens in the country. So if you're talking to family members, riding in taxis, going to shops, people have a lot of opinions and they know a lot of facts. They know a lot of facts about what's happening politically. But at the same time, a lot of it is filtered through conspiratorial thinking that, you know, I even hear people say that, oh, Iran and U.S. are actually collaborating together behind the scenes, and there's zero evidence for that. But those kind of views are kind of common. So if you go to an average person, it's not always an informed opinion, but they're very passionate about the issues. And you can talk about politics. I mean, I think it's similar in Lebanon, Iraq, other countries in the region, that you can talk about politics with a lot of people. I mean, I think in the U.S. it's very interesting because even though we talk about free speech all the time, free speech and political opinion is segregated and is pushed into very specific spaces, such as the newspaper and the university. And, you know, if you're conducting your professional work or if you're at the shop, you're not really supposed to talk about politics. But here people freely talk about politics. I even had a funny incident where I had my headphones on in a taxi, just trying to, you know, listen to some music and relax. And a taxi driver pointed at me and he's like, you know, take off your headphones. I want to talk politics. And so I had to take it off and he just rambled on about his opinions.
Wow, it sounds like, oh my gosh, there's actual people who live in Iran who behave like regular people. Iran isn't just this like cartoonishly like messed up dystopia the way it's described in the US. And I imagine there's definitely, I want to get into that. I imagine there definitely are varying opinions in Iran, but you're right. Like it would make sense that obviously a significant portion of the population would be quite supportive of these policies, or else there would be much more opposition to them in terms of Iran's role in supporting the resistance axis. And that's all so interesting. I want to ask you to elaborate a little bit. You know, you talked a little bit about a sort of, you know, which I was unaware of, that even the Shah had like a soft spot for Palestine. But, you know, Iran does have this like soft spot for Palestine. They obviously support Palestinian resistance for lots of reasons that we can get into as well. But I'm just curious, you know, when it comes to the issue of Palestine, there does seem to be a great amount of Iranian support, obviously not just in the government, but generally speaking in the country. I'm curious, why does Iran have this affinity for Palestine? I mean, it makes sense from a lot of different angles, right? Like, is part of it because Palestine is the underdog, is so obviously colonized. It's a very black and white issue. And you're just watching people suffer. Is there like a sort of, I don't know, like a brotherly sort of sympathy there? Like this is like a regional issue where people in the region are being oppressed by the same people oppressing us. What is it about Palestine that, you know, draws Iran to be so compelled to not just support it, but like in a, almost like in a spiritual way, support it?
That's right. So I would say the reasons that we support Palestine, and you mentioned some of them, I think the biggest one goes back to the earlier question and my earlier answer, is that it's the anti-imperialist principle of the revolution that has continued for the past 44 years. And if you see Israel as an extension of Euro-American settler colonialism and American imperialism, then it makes sense, following from that principle, that we should support Palestine. And it's not, I don't think it's based on a pan-Islamic idea either, because, I mean, pan-Islamic ideas were very big in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and it mobilized a lot of Muslims around the world against European imperialism, but it didn't really lead to much because we had the nation-state formations everywhere, including in the Ottoman Empire and in the Qajar dynasty. So it's less about a pan-Islamic idea, and it's more about a global fight against imperialist control and against racism and against settler colonialism. And I think a major reason I say this is because Palestine has a major Christian element. So it's not only Muslims, but there are a lot of Christian Palestinians who are under occupation. And again, going back to the anti-imperialist principle of the revolution, this is an interesting fact that I think a lot of Americans don't know. But when Iranians took the American hostages at the embassy because they alleged that the U.S. embassy was assisting the coup efforts in 1953, and they were worried that they orchestrated another coup in 1979, they actually released the black hostages. So the idea was that black Americans, even though they live in the U.S. or they live in the first world, they're oppressed. They've been historically oppressed, and they're still oppressed in 1979, and they're still oppressed, you know, in 2024. But then they released the black hostages in solidarity with black people who had suffered under American racism and American imperialism. Mm-hmm. And I would add that the support for Palestine is primarily moral and ideological as opposed to strategic. And this is in contrast to Syria, because in Syria you have an actual nation state and a state that Iran can ally with for its political objectives and for its strategic interests. But in the Palestinian case, you don't have that. So I would say it's primarily moral and ideological. But there's also a smaller realpolitik element to it, in a sense that Iran is trying to lessen American imperialism, Euro-American influence in the region, and by having more allies, including non-nation state groups such as Hamas, it thinks that it can achieve its political objectives.
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense. And, you know, when we talk about the imperialism element here, the American imperialist element here, I mean, in the U.S., obviously, you consume American media. You know very well that Iran is portrayed as just like hating America because, like, Iranians just hate freedom, or the Iranian government just like, I don't even know, the Iranian government just hates happiness and good things, and America's happiness and good things and democracy. And Iran just like hates all of these things. But also, in reality, I mean, it comes down to, you know, imperialism versus anti-imperialism. So I'm curious if you can place Iran's support for, you know, or Iran's role in the Middle East. I'm curious if, could you explain how that role actually is an anti-imperialist one? I know that sounds so simple, but I'd like for you to break that down for those who are a little confused on that element.
Sure. So I would say it is simple, because what Iran is trying to do is trying to reduce American domination of the region. And again, the U.S. has dominated the West Asian region for the past 70 plus years. I'm going back to the Baghdad Pact in 1955. And after World War II, where it becomes a superpower and it replaces Britain and France in the West Asian region. That has caused a lot of problems for the people and the countries in this region in terms of the plunder of the resources, in terms of sanctions, in terms of lack of cultural sovereignty. And all these issues, if you have certain anti-imperialism moral commitments, are problems. And the way Iran has tried to go about it is that it has tried to mobilize state power against U.S. imperialism. Because if you talk to a lot of decolonial academics or pundits in the U.S., they prefer to have non-state actors, and they prefer to have theory and non-state groups to resist imperialism. But the Iranian position is that it's better to have state power. Mobilize resources and power against American imperialism. And that's what Iran has done for the past 44 years. And one question that I want to answer that I think connects to this question is, there's this very strange and bizarre perspective that Iran itself has imperial ambitions, or that some people, I mean, it sounds ludicrous, but they say that Iran is an empire itself. It's an imperialist power in the region. But if you actually read the literature, even coming from the Western academy, and the literature on empire and on colonialism, empires have a definition. I mean, historically, pre-modern empires have a definition, and then modern empires also have a definition. They must have a very strong currency and control over world trade, global trade. They must have standing armies. They must be able to impose such things as sanctions. Again, going back to the control of global trade. And many other elements that Iran lacks. So to call Iran an empire is ludicrous. And I think part of it goes back to this new liberal or rad-lib trends in Western intellectual circles and Western academia, where anything that is not some vegan commune in Geneva is considered an empire. So empires have a definition. Even if you read Edward Said's Culture and Imperialism, he has a really good passage in that book where he contrasts the Tsars, the Russian Empire, with the British and the French. And he says that if you look at the British and the French empires, they went distances. They went, you know, they flew, they went by water, and they went over oceans in order to have colonies and territories and colonized places. But with Russia, even with the Tsars that were an empire, they were only going across their own borders. So when they captured Caucasian territories from the Iranian Qajar dynasty, that was, you know, to the south of them. But they did not go across oceans to have colonies and territories. So you even have degrees of imperial control and imperial power. And with Iran, I mean, they are a regional power, I would say, or a rising regional power, but they are not an empire. And through a state power, they're trying to lessen the American domination of the region. And that is their anti-imperialist role. And I should mention one last thing. There are a lot of pan-Iranist pundits that you find on satellite dishes and on YouTube programs that they only speak in Persian. They don't really have English programs. So I think for the American audience, they're probably very obscure. But nobody takes them seriously, and they don't have any power in the Iranian governments. But these pan-Iranists, they basically want to revive the old Achaemenid Iranian empire that stretches from Central Asia all the way to Greece. But that is not happening, and it is not part of the policy of the government. It is just the fringe pundits on YouTube programs and satellite dishes that have those imperial ambitions.
Oh, I really appreciate you breaking all that down. I think it's so important. And another thing I'd like you to delve into, I don't want to give too much time to it, because all we ever hear about is like one term you'll see a lot in the way that the resistance organizations across the Middle East are described, is they're Iranian proxies. You'll constantly hear, you know, you can't read an article about Ansarullah in Yemen, more known in the English-speaking world as the Houthis. You can't read an article in the American mainstream press without seeing the term Iranian-backed before the term Houthis, the Iranian-backed Yemeni group. That's constantly how they're referred to. Hezbollah, Lebanese Hezbollah, constantly referred to as Iranian-backed, Iranian-influenced, Iranian proxies. I mean, it's just on and on and on. It's always Iranian-backed. Of course, you never see the same terminology applied to Israel, for example, or any of the many actual proxies the U.S. has across the Middle East. Just as somebody who lives in the region, who's from the region, I find it incredibly offensive to minimize the role or the background of any single group that has an organic history in each country, whether we're talking about Ansarullah or Hezbollah in Lebanon, or these various PMF groups in Iraq. To dismiss that or minimize that as just, oh yeah, they're just like little puppets of Iran, is genuinely offensive. But, you know, from your viewpoint, Naveed, when, you know, how do you see these groups? Are they Iranian proxies? Maybe you disagree with me on that. What's your take?
No, I would say I agree with you. I mean, it's also a double standard because it is true that Iran has provided training and funding to Hezbollah and to Ansarullah, or the Houthis, as they call them in the West. but they do have their independence. And they don't take orders from Iran. It's similar to, this is true with any country. With any country, they try to, for their longevity and therefore for their stability, they try to build allies, and they try to have allies in other nation states, and we live in a order where the nation state dominates. And in order for your nation state to have longevity and stability, you need to have allies. But the difference is that with the Americans, the allies that they have is often for more greed and for more control. So they go all the way to Iraq and invade it, and they try to create an ally there, and not even an organic ally. They try to create the ally out of through force. Because with the Iranians, even though they have violated Iraqi sovereignty on several instances, there is still a very organic connection between Iran and Iraq. And historically, you had Iraqi families and Iraqi clerics who would come to Iran to study, and vice versa. And the culture is very similar. Even the expressions, you have Arabic and Persian expressions that are exactly the same. So there's this long history of interaction between Iran and Iraq. And after the war, where you have this vacuum and you have this instability in Iraq, the Iranians try to go there and, through the common faith and culture, build alliances with the Iraqis. And so the building of allies and alliances, I think it's a normal thing that nation states do. But the question is, how do you do it? Do you do it for more control and domination, or do you do it to lessen imperialist control and to bring stability to other countries? And so with the Iranian case, yes, it is trying to have allies in the region, in its own region of the world, which is in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Palestine, in Yemen, and perhaps eventually elsewhere, but they do not directly control these elements, and they do not order them to do things, as far as I understand it. Even if you look at the U.S. intelligence reports that came out after the October 7th Hamas operation in Israel, it was suggesting that there were no direct orders from Iran for Hamas to conduct this operation. I think the parachuting that they did into Israel, that might have been through Iranian training, but the operation itself was not ordered or coordinated by the Iranians, even telling by U.S. intelligence reports.
Yeah, it's just so silly that we even have to engage in that. But, it's just this thing, when something is propagandized so much, people just they absorb it without even thinking about whether it's actually accurate or not. But okay, so moving on from the proxy issue, one thing I think is important to recognize about the sort of internal destabilization that the U.S. tries to impose on Iran is that U.S. and Gulf-backed media is pretty widespread across Iran. I know that maybe some of it's blocked, but a lot of it comes through satellite, so it's impossible to block. And so there are Iranians who are exposed to certain ideas that it's pretty common for the U.S. to push into sanctioned countries. And particularly as it relates to Iran, one narrative that gets pushed by these U.S. and Gulf-backed media outlets is this idea that, your government is wasting your money on Hamas and Hezbollah and Ansar Allah, all these terrorist groups, while its own people are suffering economically. They'll never say they're suffering economically because of sanctions, but obviously Iran has had to deal with horrible, sanctions that just, ruin the economy, make it difficult to access certain items. Like we've talked before on this show about what sanctions do. And so I think this is a very useful tool for the U.S. They also promote this idea in Cuba, there's a U.S. blockade in Cuba, but rather than focus on the blockade, they'll be all your, you have all these problems and your government is the cause of it. And then we want you to hate your government for it. And this does end up resonating with some people. So I'm curious, how prevalent is that line of thinking in Iran? And moreover, Navid, does that line of thinking exist or correlate to class by any chance in terms of maybe this kind of person, not, black and white generalizations, but perhaps this kind of person from this class background typically ends up agreeing with, or that sort of U.S. line resonates with them versus somebody of a different class background?
Sure. I would say, yes. So there's a very popular perception here that's shared with among a lot of people that we are wasting our money on Palestine and Lebanon and why don't we spend it on ourselves? And it was captured, if you remember, the 2009 Green Movement that was generated because the Mousavi supporters were disputing the election, saying that there were irregularities or cheating by Ahmadinejad. When they came on the street, one of the major slogans of the protest was "Na Gazze, na Lebanon, janam fadaye Iran," which meant neither Gaza nor Lebanon, my life is for Iran, meaning that, you know, stop giving money to Gaza and Lebanon. But I think what the opposition misses here and what this perception misses here is what I was saying earlier to the last question, that the aid is not just for Palestine and Lebanon, it's also for the national stability and longevity of Iran. And in order to do that, you need to have allies and you need to have relationships with other countries. And sometimes that requires for you to spend money. And there's also funny double standard here, because the same Iranian who would say neither Gaza nor Lebanon, my life is for Iran, they would go to U.S. or Germany. And when Germany is giving money to Israel, or when U.S. is giving money to Israel or Ukraine, they're completely fine with it. They don't complain whatsoever. So there's a big double standard here, because, I mean, they're also residents of that country, so they get permanent residency in the U.S., but they're totally fine with U.S. Spending a lot of money on Israel or Ukraine. And we understand there is some difference here, because the U.S. is a wealthier country, so it could probably afford to spend more on other countries. But at the same time, a lot of that money could go to social welfare programs in the U.S. that same permanent residents could benefit from. So there is that double standard when it comes to this perception of Iran spending its money on its allies. And another thing that the opposition misses, I mean, I was mentioning this about Iran and Iraq and their organic social historical relationship, but you also have it with the Levant. So when it comes to Iranian support for Palestine and Lebanon, Iran and the Levant have deep social historical ties. And I think some historical context will help here, so to understand why Iran is so interested in building these alliances with Lebanon and Palestine. Because as early as the early 16th century, the Safavids, who were a Shia dynasty in Iran, they started patronizing the Shia ulama from Jabal Amil, which is situated in today's Lebanon, Syria, and Palestine. It kind of overlaps on the map with all three of them. And so they also bring Shia ulama from Iraq and Bahrain, but they bring a number of them from Jabal Amil, which is in the Levant. And by the end of the Safavid period, early 18th century, there are about 156 high-ranking Shia jurists who are in Jabal, who emigrated from Jabal Amil to Iran, living there. So you have that Shia migration to Iran and that relationship from the Levant. So all that knowledge, all that human resource coming from the Levant to Iran. And conversely, you also had a lot of Iranians who went to the Levant. So Suleiman the Magnificent, who was the Ottoman Sultan, he captured the northwest of Iran, where a lot of Shias lived, in, I think, the early 16th century, I think year 1534. And when that happened, he settled a lot of the population from there to Mount Lebanon. And those are the ancestors of today's Shias in Lebanon. So if you go to, I think, Byblos or Baalbek, you see a lot of Shias. Their ancestors come from northwest of Iran. So you have that big social historical relationship. And I think part of the relationship with Hezbollah, you know, it's not just wasting money, and it's not just some elitist political alliance. It's based on 500 years of social historical mm-hmm. relationship. And I think that adds an important element to it that a lot of people without historical awareness do not know about.
And just to harp on it again, the class element to this, like I would imagine, I'm guessing here, but I would imagine that perhaps people who are like more middle, upper middle class might have a certain opinion given the media they might be exposed to in like the urban centers versus people outside of those regions, as well as, you know, in a different class might have different views or ideological values when it comes to resistance in the region and supporting it, I guess.
Sure. That's an important question. And I think a question that we don't really have much data on. So a lot of the things I will say are anecdotal on this. But I would say when it comes to class, it's a pretty mixed picture, because if you're say used to a Latin American country, you might have like a cleaner class divide when it comes to a socialist government that's trying to oppose American imperialism. I'm not positive about this, but I think in Peru, for example, you might have lower classes that are more interested in a socialist anti-imperialist government over the upper classes. But in Iran, it's not like that. It's a pretty mixed picture. So you have a support for resistance from wealth. And I'm just giving the capital as an example because I live here. But the more north you go and the smaller the numbers of districts get, so districts 1 through 3, they're pretty wealthy. A lot of wealthy families live there, and a lot of them support the revolution and they support the resistance. But you also have a lot of working people who were working people or very poor before the revolution. But after the revolution, they were uplifted and incorporated into the Islamic Republic bureaucracy, and they became a new middle class. And they also support the revolution because of their experience, the positive experience they had with the Islamic Republic politics. And you also have a lot of working poor today who come out in rallies during, say, the anniversary of the revolution rallies. And they also support the resistance. And you hear the Deaf on America chants. And there's a professor at the University of Tehran, Mohammad Sami'i, who has this idea that the Deaf on America chants actually originated from the masses and from the working poor, and the political elite kind of used it. And he gives he contrasted with China, where he says that, you know, the political elite were careful not to engage in these kind of undiplomatic chants. But in Iran, it comes from the working poor. And in a sense, the political elites go along with it. So it is very mixed. So I mentioned the wealthy, the middle class, and the poor all supporting the resistance. But on the other side, you also have a lot of owners of capital and wealthy people, either from who were wealthy from the Shah era and remain wealthy or became wealthy after the revolution. And they oppose the resistance, and they think that Iran should just give up this project and become very close to the West and become a so-called normal country. And then there were the upper class who turned into the middle class after the revolution. And my own family is an example of this, because my grandfather was the deputy minister of the judiciary during the Shah period, and he was very wealthy. He had a number of lands and properties all across Tehran, and all of these were confiscated after the revolution. So he left Iran, and then everything he had was confiscated. So I became poor because of that. And that upper class turned middle class. A lot of them opposed the resistance because they had a trauma from the revolution. And similar with other revolutions, the Cuban Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, the Russian Revolution, you have property confiscation from the bourgeoisie and from the owners of capital. And that happened to a lot of people. And because of that experience, they became oppositional to the Islamic Republic project. And then I would say the third element that opposes the resistance is a cosmopolitan middle class. So the middle class is very much connected to globalized culture and to Western culture and consumerism and entertainment culture. A lot of them oppose the resistance. And a lot of times it's not because of a sound political analysis of global politics. It's more because of their emotional reaction to some of the restrictive social policies that the government has, for example, the mandatory bailing that we talked about last time on your show. And in a reaction to that, they just see the whole political project of the Islamic Republic as being a problem, and they oppose it. And a lot of times they wrongly think that the problems they have in Iran, for example, the lack of purchasing power or the lack of economic opportunities, is because of the resistance. But I think this a more sound political analysis would tell you that the reason that we lack purchasing power is not because of our fight with Israel. I mean, there are a lot of other global South countries that don't have purchasing power, and they're totally normal with Israel. Right. So there's a wrong perception. And then some of the working poor might also oppose the resistance because they're also are in economic hardship, and they kind of think that the economic hardship is tied to the resistance, which, again, I don't think is the case, but perhaps you could make a case for that.
No, I mean, I think that what I've learned from this is that we need like some Marxist PhD analysis into all of these different aspects. It is quite fascinating. But, you know, I'm also curious what the conversation inside Iran is like. And let me like narrow that down a bit. So across the Middle East in general, like in the Arab countries, I think that there's been, you know, forget what governments say, don't say, or are doing or not doing. I think among the people, and this actually I would include the diaspora across like the West, I think that Israel's behavior might not be entirely shocking because we know that Israel is capable of doing atrocious things against civilians since its founding, right? But watching it be live streamed this way, watching Western officials who prior to this claim to care so much about democracy and human rights and have always really weaponized the issue of human rights against their adversaries and claim to be these beacons of civilization, to watch them get up on podiums and say the most genocidal things, to watch them support genocide, to watch them defend Israel's destruction of hospitals, Israel's deliberate bombing of children, Israel's deliberate strategy of starvation, to see them be complicit in all that and to actually join in it now by like cutting off funding to UNRWA, to just be so mask off, right? When it comes to what they'll allow Israel to do to Palestinians in Gaza, I think has really shocked a decent amount of people into recognizing just how vicious this imperial global north system is and how subhuman not just Arabs are, but I think people across the global South are watching this and they already kind of knew, but this is like reaffirming just how capable this really vicious system is of carrying out genocidal like mass slaughter enthusiastically, right? I'm curious if there's a conversation inside Iran about that. Like, what is the conversation about Gaza? Are people even talking about it? Is it something that is, you know, on the news every day, that's in everyone's face the way it is perhaps in the rest of the region? Is it leading to conversations or maybe like an understanding that, oh, this like liberal democracy, like human rights, you know, paradigm that's been sold to us by the West is even more BS than we initially realized? Or maybe there's people who bought into it and now they don't. And I know this is all very anecdotal because you're not going around doing polls, but I guess I'm just curious, like, what's the conversation been around you with relation to this genocide in Gaza?
That's right. So I would say it's very different than the U.S. Because you don't have to worry about being doxxed or canceled here, because I have a lot of colleagues, academic colleagues in U.S. and Europe and Canada. I have to constantly worry about being doxxed or canceled because of supporting Palestine. And I think Joseph Massad, who was also on your show, there was much earlier, I think in the 2000s, there was a campaign against him to get him fired from Colombia. Just recently, because of an article he wrote about October 7th, there was a Zionist student who started a petition to get him fired. And I think it didn't work, fortunately. But there's always that pressure that if you take a pro-Palestinian position, you could be dismissed from your job. So you don't have to worry about that here, at least when it comes to the hiring and the firing of universities. But you do have to worry about being branded as an agent of the state among the intellectual class, because the intellectuals, because they see themselves from it. And it's actually very strange, because Iran is probably the only country, maybe alongside Germany, where there is a sizable intellectual community that's somewhat pro-Israeli. And by intellectuals, I mean real intellectuals, not, you know, the New York Times type intellectuals who write, you know, office for the New York Times, because they will also be pro-Israeli. But here you even have more independent intellectuals who or intellectuals who, you know, think a lot, who might side with Israel as a reaction to the state or because they want to distance themselves from the state. But there is official support. So you see propaganda posters all over the country in support of Palestine. But in addition to this official support, there's also civil support. So at the university, there were Palestinian flags that were raised. I'm not sure who raised them, but they were there. And there were events held for Palestine. So there was a poetry event for Palestine where a lot of people participated. And there were also exhibitions about Palestine and poster paintings about Palestine that were put up. So there's a lot of pro-Palestinian sentiment on the university campus, despite the kind of the intellectual opposition that I mentioned. And I would say there's also general sorrow because you mentioned that in the West, minus certain subcultures, and even though it's changing, I think this is for the first time that we're seeing more people supporting Palestine in the West. But in contrast to the West, I would say there's a general sense of sorrow here about what is happening in Palestine. But because Iran does not have an imperialist role in the world, a lot of people don't really get that interested or involved in affairs outside the country. And I mentioned this, I think, before on your show, that when there was the election in Venezuela and the U.S. claimed that it was rigged, and you know there was a whole crisis of Western countries worrying about democracy and human rights again. When I would ask my Iranian friends, what do you think about the elections in Venezuela? They would just say that, I hope the Venezuelan people figure it out. So they don't have this, because even in the U.S. within the left, you have this kind of constant need to have an opinion on foreign affairs. But here, a lot of people are just, you know, it's an affair that's not about me. So they might not have a strong opinion about it. But there is a sense of general sorrow because of the human toll and the atrocities that Israel is committing in Gaza and also in other occupied territories.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear the rest, you can access it by becoming a Breakthrough News member at patreon.com/breakthroughnews.